I'm delighted to welcome to the program Silvia Rodriguez. She's Professor Emerita of Anthropology and former director of the Ortiz Center for Intercultural Studies at the University of New Mexico. And on Tuesday, the 15th of January, she'll be speaking about acequias, activism, and collaborative research on acequias at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, sponsored by Amigos Bravos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking about acequias and the history of acequias. I mean, these go back many centuries and go back far beyond New Mexico.
Right. Acequias are small-scale irrigation communities that took root and grew here in New Mexico during the colonial period. They're still operating, and they're struggling to survive. The Pueblo people, of course, had their own techniques for managing water and were familiar with flood irrigation, although it was probably in the northern part of the state, in the upper Rio Grande, not their mainstay. There were many ways, ingenious ways, of harvesting water and growing things. When the Spaniards came up, some think that, of course, they came up through Mexico, that some of the techniques that they brought were enriched by Tlaxcalan Indians, who they brought with them. But in any case, this whole body of technology and regulation and tradition came from North Africa and went into the Iberian Peninsula during the 800 years of Moorish occupation. So a lot of the, actually even the terms, but the practices and the technology of irrigation as we see here in New Mexico has its origins, its ancient origins in the Middle East and in the Iberian Peninsula. So when the Spanish came, they brought that, and Oñate, who had the first settlement colony in 1598 out of near where Okeohingé is now, according to their chronicles, one of the first things they did was dig ditches to divert water from the river to feed fields. And each of the communities that was established during the colonial period was either, first of all, near pueblos, who already had this rich tradition of agriculture. But what the Spanish brought, I think, transformed Pueblo agriculture in many ways and affected them in profound ways. But the first thing people had to do was dig ditches in order to divert water from tributaries or the main stem and dig this whole system of ditches and then administer these ditches to feed people's fields. So what grew up were these acequias en común, or these sort of community irrigation communities, that still are operating today in many parts of the state, primarily but not exclusively in northern New Mexico. Here in Santa Fe, there was a rich acequia tradition, much of which is now only operating in very small parts of the city. There was an archaeologist who, David Snow, who years ago did a monograph for the city on sort of the history of acequias and mapped them. But, of course, the system is no longer really fully operative here right in the city, and that probably has some effect on how the river's going dry. But anyway, there, where I've done my work, of course, is primarily in the Taos area, where I worked on, I think it's probable that the Taos system is maybe the largest and most elaborate. If you take it as a whole, I mean, each of these tributaries, each of these little communities, Taos, like the settlement pattern of northern of New Mexico along the Rio Grande and its tributaries, were sort of a central town in these outlying satellite communities. And that's what Taos is, the town of Taos, and then about 15 still existing pre-American colonial era and Mexican era communities, all of which are on ditches. And so the ditches are integral, and were one of the sort of backbones of community organization and cooperation. And the management and the governance of these systems is in itself a really interesting and important way of operating the commons, water as the commons. And New Mexico acequias really belong to a larger family of small-scale irrigation communities that you find all over the world, probably on every continent. And they're all facing similar problems, which is, of course, historically, as areas became colonized and then incorporated into nations, or these sort of bureaucratic centralized state systems that want to sort of take over the management and expand a lot of these systems and bring very different principles to operate rather than sort of a community-based, you know, working the commons kind of thing. So the struggle against sort of bureaucratic, state-centered, centralized ways of operating you see all over the world, and also more recently bringing in, you know, technologies such as fertilizer and, you know, non-organic ways of trying to increase production. Here in New Mexico, there are many things that that challenge the acequias. First of all, sort of the decline of farming. And after World War II, there was, you know, less and less, you know, fewer and fewer traditional Hispanic farmers, as well as, of course, the Pueblos, engaged in agriculture because it wasn't economically viable. And that's one of the things, is sort of people moving away from irrigated agriculture, but also with the growth of cities and development, the need to transfer water rights away from agriculture into other uses. Since all the water in the state, all the surface water is already allocated, there's no new water in the state. So one of the main sources for subdivisions, cities, places like Intel, is to transfer surface water away from traditional agricultural uses to other uses. So the transfer of water rights is one of the things that acequias are sort of trying to control, trying to fight, and they've made some progress in that. So the water market, as you know, the population and cities grow, the demand for water to non-agricultural uses is increasing, and so water rights are incredibly expensive.
Well, let's get back to that in a moment, but let's talk, it's very interesting the language you use to describe acequias. You call them irrigation communities, and of course community is a very human term, so it's not, you're not just talking about the physical fact of the ditch that's used or the canal that's being used to divert water, but the way it's used and how people do it. How are, I mean, when you talk about water as commons, how have acequias traditionally been used and administered, and how did that work with the larger community that was farming around them?
Say you're on a stream that's a tributary of the Rio Grande, as in the case of the Taos Basin, which is where I'm most familiar, you have these sort of several streams, five streams right in the basin. Each of these streams, there is a mother ditch, an acequia madre, that diverts off of a stream, and off of that mother ditch are smaller laterals. The acequia, these serve communities that are self-identified, that usually have, well, sometimes a centralized placita, sometimes a more dispersed pattern of settlement. They have usually their own chapel. They have their own, often their traditional penitente morada. They have their camposanto, or their graveyard. They have their patron saint, who is the patron of their chapel. They're usually part, they're always part of a larger parish. Everybody who has a piece of farmland or land with water rights, which they've inherited, because we're talking about people who've been on the land for generations. And of course, the history of how a lot of that land was lost is another story in New Mexico, and that too has had a tremendous economic impact on farming here in New Mexico. But if you are a land owner and you have irrigated land, that means you're a parciante, which is that you're part of this acequia association. And there are rules of the ditch. Every year, the parciantes get together and elect a mayordomo, or a ditch boss, who is traditionally a man, although there are now women mayordomos, who is really the person who allocates the water and is in charge of sort of distributing the water in times of scarcity, as well as when there's plenty of water and a good year of runoff. He or she is assisted by usually a three-person commission. And together, these elected officials really preside over all ditch business, that is, maintenance of the physical infrastructure. So acequia literally means the ditch, but when people talk about acequias, they also mean this association. And the principles by which the water is distributed is really one of sharing scarcity. It's not a zero-sum game, which is really how prior appropriation operates in state law and in Western water law, which is a very different principle, which means that in times of scarcity, really people sort of, no one goes completely without if it's physically possible, and people share the scarcity. In times of abundance, people can take water as needed, but they always sort of need to clear it with the mayordomo. So you have this sort of ditch boss, basically, who is someone who has to have intimate knowledge of the physical layout of the ditches. And when I was doing, I grew up on an acequia, so acequias go way back for me. And I think my love of a ditch is just my own experience as a child of hearing the ditch and playing with the ditch and the importance of the ditch in the neighborhood where I grew up. And it wasn't until many years later that I began to talk to and work with people on the acequias and understand how extensive and intimate their knowledge is of place and the kind of local knowledge they have, not only of the topography and how the water flows and the kinds of soils, but also of weather. And the managing a ditch, being a mayordomo, was a really tough job, and because people want their water when they want their water. So it's really a job that requires intimate knowledge of the physical infrastructure, of the behavior of water. Certainly, to be a mayordomo, one has himself or her house to be a farmer and to know how to irrigate. But also diplomacy, knowledge of people, an ability to read the weather, and to, during times of, you know, when if there's a storm in the middle of the night, to get out there, keep the ditches, keep the channels clear, and keep the water flowing and deliver the water to people in a timely fashion. If you're a parciante, your obligations are to pay your dues, and every ditch has dues to pay, to keep for, you know, maintain infrastructure, also sometimes to pay the mayordomos, who traditionally are either not paid or usually quite underpaid. But you need to also contribute labor to the maintenance of the ditch. And you'll see this, I've actually seen it in Acequia Madre a few years ago. I saw the mayordomo there cleaning the ditch. But everyone goes on a certain day. If you're a parciante, either you go yourself or you send, you know, a younger male person or a female person in your family, or you hire a peon to go and clean the ditch. And depending on how long the ditch is, people, that depends on how long it takes. So you, it's a contribution of communal labor to the maintenance of the physical system. That is the acequia madre. You're responsible for the ditches on your own land. So that's an important kind of secular ritual that takes place, that's for the maintenance of the ditch, but also is a time when people get together and, you know, gossip and find out what's happening. And it's the ditch, I think, is a way of not only delivering water and making it possible to live in the subsistence economy that grew up here, but today even, it's a kind of connectivity among people. I think you find people who are no longer subsisting, either mainly by farming, who are in part of the wage labor market or whatever, but who are tenaciously defending their water rights, which are under increasing demand because of the water market, but who hold to that piece of land and to the ditch because that's who they are. And they have a strong sense of community commitment and identity that's, I think, based on land and based on the system of acequia and interconnection, that sharing the water and allocating the water and having to deal with your neighbors in a cooperative way over a resource that's basically scarce. Fosters. And so you have these two sides of sort of competition on the one hand for water in this arid desert environment, and on the other hand, cooperation, these two sides of the same coin.
We're talking to Silvia Rodriguez. Let's talk for a moment about the historical relationship between the Spanish acequia communities and the Pueblos in the Taos area. You were saying that the Pueblos had their own way of doing irrigation, but were also affected by the acequia communities?
Sure. When the Spanish came, of course, they brought a whole suite of flora and fauna that changed, completely transformed the ecology of the area. One of the things the acequias did, and again, I think archaeologists aren't in complete agreement about how much actual flood irrigation in the upper Rio Grande the Pueblos were doing. They were certainly familiar with it, and I don't want to get into, you know, to what extent that was the case. But with the coming of the Spanish and the Spanish colonial settlers, you had the extension of the digging of ditches where there weren't ditches before. And so what that did was extend the riparian habitat. So the landscape that we see today in New Mexico is a product of the acequias, because if you extend the riparian habitat, that means there's, you know, flora and fauna that goes along the borders of the ditch. And so the green of the area is largely, you know, always been concentrated along the rivers, on the tributaries of the rivers, but then the acequias extended that. One of the things that has been, that Parcientes have known for many years, but that has now been confirmed through scientific research, is that flood irrigation recharges the aquifer, which also can recharge the stream itself. So in this long history of Pueblo-Hispano relations is one of both competition and cooperation, and, you know, sort of a bittersweet relationship. But certainly with the introduction of old world crops and animals, it changed the landscape as well as agricultural practices in profound ways. And Pueblos and their Hispanic neighbors had to share the water, and they did share the water. And in each area, I think the history and sort of the character of relationships is a little bit different, just like each community has its own personality. So you can make some generalizations, but really you sort of need to look at each particular community and its neighbors to understand the dynamics of what's been going on historically.
So each era seems to have its own kind of scarcity. In our current era, we have all these ways of diverting water and digging deep to get water, but we're also overusing it and creating scarcity once again. There was a big agreement signed in 2006 about which you've written, but talk about the dynamics of water and water rights in New Mexico, and in particular in northern New Mexico right now. I mean, as I understand, the person who has originally had the rights has first claim to the water, is that correct?
With the coming of the Americans, you had legal developments that changed water law, new water laws. One of the principles of water in the West and here in New Mexico is prior appropriation. And that means that first in right, first in time. First in time, first in right, which potentially could be a zero-sum game in the sense that the oldest water rights in the Upper Rio Grande are held by the Pueblos. Since they precede European and American, that the next oldest water, and those water rights are not alienable, just like Pueblo land is not alienable. It's held by the tribes and it's held in trust by the federal government.
And it's permanent.
It's permanent. The next oldest water rights are those held by the acequias, and those go back hundreds of years in some cases, and establishing these priority dates is itself a problem. But those water rights potentially can be bought. I mean, one of the things that happens with the coming of American legal system is that water can be separated from the land. You can separate water, buy water rights separately and transfer them away from land. Previously, I don't think people thought about the possibility of doing that. It was unthinkable that you would simply sell your water rights, thereby leaving that piece of land from which the water rights have been sold forever fallow, forever barren. So there's this market for water rights. And one of the things that's had a tremendous impact, and I think it's been one of the triggers for acequia activism, are the water rights adjudications, AMOT being the most famous one here in the Santa Fe area. There are many adjudications going on, and that's really to determine who's what the priorities are. Of course, these are legal cases that pit the Pueblos against all junior water rights owners. In the Taos area, the case was known as Abeta. And that went on these are some of the oldest legal cases in the American system. But I think that the Abeta case was, I think, filed in either 67 or 69. It was settled recently out of court through a negotiated settlement that took more than 17 years of negotiated settlement between the Taos Valley Acequia Association, Taos Pueblo, and other claimants, the town of Taos, a couple of sanitation districts.
So what was that issue? Basically, who gets the water?
Who owns the water rights, and in what priority, and how much, and for what? And all of these adjudications are going up and down the Rio Grande. And what kicked these off was really the San Juan Chama water, which was, since all the water is already allocated in the state, all growth along the Rio Grande is made possible by the importation of water from the Colorado River into New Mexico. Since the Colorado River doesn't really run through New Mexico, it's imported through these giant channels that were dug To bring water across the continental divide into the tributaries of the Rio Grande, and then the establishment of reservoirs to store that water. All of the growth of Santa Fe, of Albuquerque, and even of Taos is dependent on the importation of this water. And, of course, water in the Colorado is going down. So this is one of the issues. I mean, this is such a complicated issue. I don't want to really get into all the details. But basically what these cases have done in the Powaki Basin and in the Taos Basin was to pit the Pueblo or the Pueblos against junior owners. And these are enormously complicated and slow-moving cases, and people have all kinds of opinions about them. The Taos settlement was reached and finally signed very recently. What it means basically is that because the importation of Colorado water does not take place in the actual flowing of physical new water into the Rio Grande is below where Taos is, they've dug all these wells to sort of take the water out of the ground to compensate for the water that will, in other words, they're taking water out of the ground instead of out of the river. That's true in Santa Fe. Of course, people started with the Buckman Wells started drinking the river. In Albuquerque, they started a few years ago drinking the river because the aquifers cannot be continuously mined. The bottom line is, with all of these increasing demands on water, and then of course the issue of climate change, the scarcity of water and the scramble for water is going to intensify. The pressure of the water market, the transfer of water rights, the water rights adjudication, development depending on the transfer of water right off the dishes are all factors that have contributed to the emergence of activism on the Acequias. You could say in a way that never before have the Acequias been so close to extinction, and at the same time never have they been so organized, and never have they been so studied and celebrated.
Well, one of the things that you're going to be talking about in your talk, we're talking to Silvia Rodriguez about acequias and about water, and is the scientific and academic and community collaborative research that's going on about acequias, which is fairly new and very exciting.
Yeah, I think what I'm going to be talking about is sort of the emergence of acequia activism, looking at particular instances, those that I'm most familiar with, which is when people on acequias began to organize, not just on one acequia, but between acequias, to form coalitions to fight certain kinds of trends of development. And one of the examples of that was back in the days of Indian Camp Dam in Taos, which John Nichols sort of fictionalized in the Milagro Beanfield War, when acequias on three different streams, and they call themselves Tres Valles, began to organize to fight what they thought would be detrimental ultimately to their water rights and to their farming. That was sort of a precursor. When the water rights adjudication in Taos y Abeyta case began to gear up in the 1980s, the Taos Valley Acequias Association emerged, which was really a federation of ditches on several streams in the Taos Basin. And they organized in order to meet the tremendous demands of preparing for the adjudication, including raising funds and organizing to inform people about the process, because each individual paciente had to get involved in establishing when their priorities were. And these organizations, the Taos Valley Acequia Association, and then later on, the New Mexico Acequia Association, which is now the umbrella organization for acequias in the state, and they have regions where acequias are organized sort of according to type, to meet the demands of the adjudication. And they've worked also on legislation that helps strengthen the position of acequias in several ways with respect to water rights transfers and also with water banking. But what you have is sort of the emergence, the slow growth of these coalitions of acequia associations and their organizations statewide at this point, not only for purposes of preparing for adjudication, but for education, for developing programs that help strengthen the traditions of the acequias. Help farmers, get grants for infrastructure, inform people. So you have this sort of emergence of ever sort of greater levels of organization to meet the increasing demands and challenges that are facing people's ability to hold on to their water rights. These irrigation communities, of which Esekias are one example in the world, are called by anthropologists autonomous irrigation communities. They're not politically autonomous in that Esekias associations, for example, are subdivisions of the state and are subject to state statute and are regulated by state statute. But in the sense that you have these communities that, in a very limited local way, actually control their water supply, which if you look in the urban world today is a fairly unusual thing. The mutual domestic water associations do that too, and they have local control. And it's a form of communal cooperation that is, I think, very instructive and very, from which we can learn a lot.
Now, how are they working with scientists who are also studying Esekias?
Well, one of the things I think is happening all over the world now, as we, people say the 21st century water is going to be one of the main crisis resources, is that there's a growth. You could say that the study of water, scientifically, but also in a social science way, in all across the board, is a growth area now. I mean, the amount of publication and journals that are coming out dealing with water is expanding. As local areas, regional areas, nations are beginning to struggle more and more for water, as water, fresh water particularly is a limited supply, and you have increasing demands on it. So there's more study of water going on scientifically and in other areas. And, of course, engineers and hydrologists have been studying water forever. But I think what you have now is the realization increasingly that the study of water can't be limited just to physical science, because this is economic, it's political, it's cultural, it's social. Water is something that sort of all areas of sort of human endeavor deal with. We can't live without this resource. So it's... we're in an era now, which I call sort of a new era of the scientific study of Esekias, here in New Mexico, as is going on all over the world. And one of the things I'm going to be talking about, and one of the main things, is sort of the emergence of multidisciplinary studies across, hydrologists working with range scientists, working with ecologists, working with biologists, now also working with social scientists to understand Esekias as part of ecological systems. There's a very interesting study going on that's funded by the National Science Foundation, the PI, the main PI, Sam Fernald, who's done some really interesting
PI?
Work, primary investigator. NSF is now funding culture-nature coupling systems. And so this particular study is looking at three sites in northern New Mexico that's looking at Esekias as part of an ecological system in the context of watersheds, which is a very holistic way of looking at them, not just as sort of these isolated or historically interesting institutions, but is really integral to the landscape and to the whole system of the watershed. So you have physical scientists working now with social scientists. Where I come in is, and where I've done work is as an anthropologist, is what is the nature of the sort of cultural traditions and the social traditions that are part of the Esekias? You can't really understand the system without hydrology, without ecology, without biology, without range science. You need all of that. But you also need to understand sort of the values and the practices and the cultural institutions that are integral
to the maintenance. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that this particular study is interested in is what are the trigger? Are there tipping points when an Esekias system, which is a farming system, it's a community system, it's part of an ecological system, it's part of the watershed. What are the factors sort of all across these different dimensions that contribute to the maintenance and the resilience of this system? Because they're really studying resilience through time. These wouldn't be here if they weren't resilient and sustainable. What are the factors that contribute to resilience as well as challenge it, the threat? So they're trying to sort of figure out, are there economic tipping points? Are there tipping points in the terms of the quantity of water, with either through the transfer of water or the ultimate, I think, challenge is, legally, and you can try to fight water right transfers, but if the water supply, the physical water supply, which we know is increasingly going to be the case with climate change, that the runoff, the precipitation is going to go down, how can these be sustained? I mean, what are the various factors? And so one of the things we're looking at is people's values, the way they participate in the community. I mean, you have to ask people, you know, why do you still irrigate when you work in town, when your children have had to migrate out for education and employment, when the actual amount of stuff that you're growing has changed over the decades, and you're not, it's an important part of your household economy, but your mainstay is really other forms of making a living. Why is it so important to you? And what are the factors? What is it you get out of it? And why, you know, why are people fighting so tenaciously to hold on to what is in fact a precious economic resource, but that is also like a whole institution by which people remain in touch with each other? So trying to understand the nature of sort of the cultural and the social aspects of acequias and how those relate to the economic and the sort of ecological aspect, looking at it holistically.
And as you said before, it's so much part of people's identity that that in itself is a motive.
Right. When you talk to one of the kinds of studies I've been talking about is sort of these multidisciplinary scientific studies. Another project is participatory action research. Traditional research done from universities is usually conceived of within the context of the university to address questions that are current in the discipline. And you sort of decide what questions you're going to research, you plan it out, and you go out and do it. Community-based participatory action research is research that really comes out of a community when a community of interest decides that they're facing particular issues and problems that concern them, and they decide that they want to find out how to deal with it, what the nature of that problem is and how to address it. So it's a very practical, pragmatic way of addressing issues of a community of interest. One of the projects I've been involved in is in collaboration with the New Mexico Seki Association around what they call the Mayordomo crisis, which is that the old Mayordomos are dying. They're taking their knowledge with them, and it's getting harder and harder to recruit young people to become Mayordomos. So in collaboration with the NMAA, sort of a team of us worked to address the Mayordomo crisis, which involved going out and talking to Mayordomos and finding out, you know, what is it they do? How do they do it? How did they learn what they were doing? In order to develop a program to recruit and train a new generation of Mayordomos.
Did it work?
It's in process now. It's been a really exciting and maybe one of the most rewarding research projects I've ever done, because it's completely team. It's completely participatory in the sense that there's Mayordomos, commissioners, a graduate student, staff from the New Mexico Seki Association, myself, engaged in the different stages of this research project, which started with what an academic would call interviews with Mayordomos, but what they call pláticas, which are chats that were recorded, talks that were recorded and then analyzed to find out what is it Mayordomos actually do. And so sort of eliciting these oral pláticas from these traditionally very knowledgeable, skillful people about the nature of their knowledge and the complexity of what they do in order to, again, address the crisis and see if we can, in fact, succeed in interesting a new generation of people to become Mayordomos and the nature of this knowledge. The traditional way people learned all this stuff, of course, which is can't be replaced, is by doing it and by watching your elders do it.
Right. I would think that they would say, oh, well, everybody knows how to do this. We grew up doing it. And the very idea that it would disappear is probably sort of crazy.
Well, the incentives, you know, are not. It's like just like farming in this very difficult environment. It's getting harder and harder to do that. Yeah. I think people are beginning to realize that we're in big trouble if that goes away in any number of ways. I mean, you have young suburban kids taking up organic farming today, you know, and the whole food security movement and food movement are part of this, I think, larger development of sort of reevaluating local knowledge, local production, and local institutions, community organizations that work to operate a commons. So part of the product of the Mayordomo project is a recruitment video, which has been produced and is now under copyright and will be distributed. And another is a handbook, which is basically a really practical handbook on how to be a Mayordomo, which won't replace working with a mentor, but will sort of complement that process. So this is, both of these projects that I'm talking about are sort of in process right now.
Silvia Rodriguez is Professor Emerita of Anthropology and former director of the Ortiz Center for Intercultural Studies at the University of New Mexico. And on Tuesday, January 15th, she will be speaking about acequias and activism and all the stuff that we've been talking about and more at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which is on the corner of Helena Street and Paseo de Peralta, between Old Santa Fe Trail and Acequia Madre, and that's sponsored by Amigos Bravos. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and I hope you come back and continue the conversation.
Thank you.